The Dignity of Dependence, a Feminist Manifesto. How's that for a provocative title? So excited to dive into Lee Labresco Sargent's new book, which is going to blow your mind. If you are a woman or no one, I just narrowed it down a bit. You're going to find this a fascinating topic today on The Chris Stefanik Show. Welcome to The Chris Stefanik Show. We're here every week to give you the tools and inspiration you need to live your everyday life with joy. I want to thank our missionaries of joy who make all this work possible. Click below this video to become one. Also, if you want us to bless you with daily inspiration, no strings attached, click below this video and sign up for the Daily Anchor. And you can catch this and so much more on EWTN Plus streaming, link below in the show notes. Let's dive in. Lee Labresco Sargent, thanks so much for being back.
My pleasure.
I love talking to you. I was going to throw this whole interview away about your new book and just talk about your role-playing game that you and your husband have invented that's based on Tolkien's works.
Back again from the Broken Land, specifically, you've missed the Scouring of the Shire in the movies. Now you get to play it.
Wow.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, seriously.
You can have me back a third time. We'll just set up and do an actual play, right?
People could just watch that or just zone out. I don't really care. How do I get my hands on this?
You can find it at Cloven Pine Games on itch.io.
Honestly?
Yes, you can just get it. You can play it right now. It's a one-shot, no prep.
I'm so excited right now. Like, I heard you had done this. I was kind of just kidding, but we are going to actually talk about this book, but I can get this game. We're linking to that in the video notes below, too. Mm-hmm. Way to go.
It's so much fun.
Way to fully geek out, too, and go there.
This is why I married him, right? I knew this. Not this specifically, but I saw the potential.
It's a match made in Numenor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a big tattoo guy, but I have a very small tattoo in Elvish.
Serious? Under my arm. What does it say?
The number 9.
For the fellowship?
The fellowship. Okay. And then me and my wife, 6 kids, 1 miscarriage, 9 of us.
Mm-hmm.
So there's our little,
that's really
our little family crest.
I love that.
Yeah, pretty cool. But for real, we're going to actually talk about this. The Dignity of Dependence, a Feminist Manifesto. I love this.
Mm-hmm.
This was, I mean, I read it this weekend. An incredible amount of work. So way to go. I could see years of thought developing and grappling with so many issues that converge here from moral to political to human to sociological and philosophical. And it's all just kind of, here you go. This is not quick reading.
Mm-hmm.
This is a thick steak, right? Well, and there's a lot in here to unpack that could have a lot of change.
Honestly, like my last book, Building the Benedict Option, it's a book I hope people pause while they're reading because I want you to stop reading the book and phone someone and invite them over or pray with them because you're moved to do that by thinking about what connects us rather than going right to the end of the book.
It's beautiful. Okay, so we live in a world shaped by men for men in a very real way. And you go about addressing that in a way that's not a critical theory, deconstructionist, I hate men, which is one of the things that sets a Christian, a Catholic feminism apart from a secularist, angry one. But what do you mean by that? Spell that out. Share some examples with us about what that means.
So there are a lot of kind of trivial ways in which men and women are different. You know, you can think about a lot of this in that overlapping bell curves way, right? Women have a variety of heights, but men are on average taller, right? You can find some women taller than some men, but you can make some generalizations about what's true. And then there's some physical differences that are, the bell curves are so far apart, there's almost no overlap. And one of the funniest ones for me is grip strength, where on average, women have much lower grip strength than men. And you know, what I like about this example is it's well-measured. It has no moral relevance. There's no sense of, well, you know, because women's grip strength is so low, they shouldn't have the right to vote, right? Like, but it makes a difference for how the world is, you know, that you'll have objects that really are you know, screwed on more tightly than many women can casually do without assistance. And we make choices about what should be the way this is attached. And is it the way that most people can open or just most men? And what I think this points at is something bigger than jars, right?
Yeah.
I think what feels very fragile in our world is there a way for men and women to be equal in dignity if they aren't interchangeable? And that there's a lot of nervousness about that question. It leads us to kind of minimize the real differences between men and women because there's a fear that if we look too closely at them, we might have to give up that idea of equal in dignity. Because in a secular context, it's harder to say what makes people equal if not sameness.
Did you know that for just $15 a month, you can change lives? Seriously,
$15 a month. That's the cost of a couple lattes. But instead of coffee, you're fueling something eternal. Because of our Missionaries of Joy, our monthly supporters, people are coming back to the church. Families are being strengthened. The gospel is reaching millions. Everything we do, the Chris Stefanik Show, life-changing video series like Living Joy, Rise, Fearless, and Renewed, our live events, it all exists because of people like you. For just $15 a month, you can become part of this mission. And as you participate in this work, we're going to equip you, inspire you, and empower you to live the gospel in your daily life and to help others do the same. When you become a monthly donor, a Missionary of Joy, you're not just donating, you're actually making this mission possible. You're helping us bring hope, truth, and joy to a world that desperately needs it. And that's not all. As a Missionary of Joy, you get exclusive access to all our video series and empowerment to share them in small groups with friends. You get exclusive early access to new releases. You get Monday motivation texts direct from me. And you get access to our daily anchor, daily inspiration to fuel your faith. For less than 50 cents a day, you could bring the joy of the gospel to the world that desperately needs it. Please sign up in the link below this show description. We literally can't do this work without you.
And grip strength, like, people can concede that. Some people really hold out against the evidence, but they can concede and go like, well, that's a weird thing, but we're basically the same. But then you don't have a framework for talking about some of our bigger differences, with the most obvious being fertility, the capacity to bear a child, one of the biggest asymmetries between men and women. And if you don't have a robust theory of what it means to be human that allows men and women to differ in this way and remain equal in dignity, then you wind up living in the world that unfortunately we do live in a lot of the time, where women are treated like defective men.
It's where a powerful statement.
Diverge from what's normal, which is here not having babies. And then it's our job to figure out how to close the gap as best we can by either minimizing the cost of what our children ask of us or by getting rid of the children entirely.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're going to go more into that. But there was a couple other examples you brought up that were really striking about how literally in a mechanical way the world is more built for men. Because when I first read that, I thought, oh, come on, I don't know. But then I'm reading about, oh, wait, the medicine.
Yes.
The cars.
Like, yes,
you know,
oh, the cars.
There's real life and death things going on here.
And the cars are one I think people know pretty well, as long as you share a car with your spouse, right? Like, because men and women are different in height, which usually doesn't feel so relevant, most men and women, if they share a car, well, you get in the car that your wife drives or the car your husband usually drives, and the first thing you do is that thunk of moving the seat so that each of you can reach the pedals, you know, comfortably. And that feels like, oh, it's a little annoying, but how much does it matter? But in fact, the way we've designed airbags are really designed more for the distance that men are away from the steering wheel rather than the distance that women are. And it means that women get injured a lot more in car crashes by airbags because they're very close and the percussive force hits you, throws you back in a way it's not supposed to.
It's crazy.
And when they interviewed this guy who works in car design about this, like, well, is there ways to adjust this? Can we design it more to accommodate all women? He kind of blamed women. He's like, well, you know, like, there's only so much we can do. You know, women are too close and too fragile. As though it's our fault about our legs, right? Like, and I think a lot of those differences are framed that way, including by folks who identify as feminists who have the goal of helping women, that there's something sort of wrong with women. Mm. Women are too close, not just to airbags, but to other people's needs, too close to a baby, too close to their elderly parents, and too fragile. Wow. Too exposed to the world. And it's a woman's job, either, you know, told to her by someone who dislikes women, to kind of find a way to firm up, distance herself, become less who she is so that she is more like what we've designed for, or by someone who likes women, someone who identifies as a feminist but says, like, okay, I've got to help you find a way to navigate this demand to be better at being a man. And then I'm giving you this advice in good faith about, well, you've got to make war against your fertility because it's holding you back. And as I love you, I don't want you to be held back by the fact you're a woman. How can we make your womanness less relevant to you?
Too close, too fragile. That analogy is pretty powerful.
Yeah.
I mean, on one level, it's just, why are we only doing crash tests with male crash test dummies?
Yep.
Why don't we give a shot at half the human race that's behind the wheel? But that carries right through. And this is you bring up really beautifully where most postmodern feminism is getting it wrong. That the goal is for a woman to come into a man's structure and world and win.
Yes.
And dominate. on masculine terms, rather than changing the playing field, which another analogy is, mm-hmm. is women's basketball.
Mm-hmm.
Your argument is that we should change the playing field itself to fit women better. And frankly, I got to say, reading this as a man, I'm thinking, that's the world I want to live in. It's going to fit humanity better.
Mm-hmm.
But you bring up that word dependence, and as the rallying cry for how to do this, that this is not a bad word. You know, in a world that's been dominated by a lot of masculine ideals in the wrong way,
mm-hmm.
the American dream is all about fierce independence.
Yes.
And here you are saying, no, this is something that's central to femininity that we need to celebrate, lean into, for the sake of everybody, and
mm-hmm.
make this a mainstream part of how society structures itself. Defend the word
yes.
dependence. Why is this a good thing?
Well, and people
in America,
say like,
and why should it be?
You got to be careful at this dependence burden.
Yeah.
These are bad things. You know, these are
yeah.
pejorative words. Like, you know, is it fair to reclaim them? Is it possible to reclaim them? And I think there's no other option, right? Because there's ways that women are more obviously exposed as mutually dependent, exposed to the dependence of others, especially through pregnancy. But independence is not a masculine virtue, right? Because every man starts his life as a baby and is not any less a man for doing that, right?
Mm.
So when we talk about what does it mean to be human, we often talk as though independence, autonomy are the fullest expression of our humanity. What does that mean for the rest of our life? Well, the very beginning, both in utero and out, it's awkward. Like, you're clearly not really a good human because you need someone else. Yeah. And in utero, people are more comfortable saying, simply not human, but a baby is no different once they're delivered. They
yeah.
still can't survive without someone else. It just changes who they depend on. So suddenly this ideal of autonomy means a lot of our infancy, childhood, that's all not real life. We let you have it because it's kind of a prelude, an entre-act to real life, and you're developing in a certain direction, but that's not real life.
Mm.
Okay, well, now you're in your 20s. You're a young, strapping man, like in his 20s, very strong, physically fit, your parents aren't old, they don't need anything from you yet, like you're independent, great work. And if you're very lucky, you're hit by a bus at 38, right? Like you've lived a full, vigorous, flourishing human life untouched by your own frailty.
Just at 50, you're just dead.
Yes, or other yeah. people's, right? And because if you don't do that, well, what happens? Like, oh, well, your parents are older, one of them has dementia issues, so suddenly their frailty impacts your life. You were autonomous, but now you're almost no less shaped by the need of someone else than your wife is shaped by the need of the baby growing inside her.
Mm.
There's someone who's not you who needs you in a profound and intimate way, which compromises your own autonomy, your ability to be a law unto yourself.
Mm.
And then, of course, if you aren't so lucky as to be hit by a bus before your parents are old, then eventually you'll be old. And many of us end our lives as we began it, in diapers, with someone caring for us. And the more we tell this story about human life as being fundamentally about autonomy, the more we have to recognize, well, that's only describing these like brief periods of life, like when
yeah.
we happen to be physically strong and when no one we love is physically weak. It cuts a huge amount of our life out of real life entirely. And it means we have to, if we believe this lie of autonomy, male or female, spend a lot of our lives despising ourselves.
Mm. Especially women.
Especially women. And that's the thing, which is, I think the lie of autonomy is a lie for men and for women. But a man can live within it comfortably for longer.
Yeah.
Not indefinitely. He's going to get caught out in the end. But it fits him a little more naturally, just like the car airbag does. It's a little more tailored to him, not perfectly. But for women, you know, the fact of our fertility means we're exposed to the needs of others in a very profound and intimate way, in a way that can never be fully chosen. Even when you're trying to conceive, everyone knows you can't do that just by wishing, right? Like,
yeah.
you need someone who loves you to make a baby with. And even when you have that, it's no guarantee that a baby will come along or that when one does, you'll successfully carry that baby to term. Babies are a moment of profound vulnerability even when they're sought, because they really expose the limits of what we can author for ourselves, the limits of that our own law we can create for ourselves.
And a woman who's embracing her femininity and is open to you know, fertility, to life, it presents that challenge to society.
Yes.
Right? If we're to have a world that women are welcome in any sector, well, then it has to be a world that welcomes, is open to, celebrates the concept of human interdependence.
Yes. And celebrates it as not fully chosen or authored or controlled,
yeah.
right? Because what you see a lot more is this tendency of like, well, it's great that women can have children, but they better do it in an extremely responsible way, in a very controlled way. You'd better not have a child with serious disabilities that you could have screened for, because if you do that, that's your fault, right? Not the act of having a child is welcoming a person. And that person, whether born with congenital disabilities or not, will have a life where they need people at various times, some people more profoundly, some people more at different times than others. But it creates this illusion that, you know, the able-bodied sibling to the disabled child you aborted, like, is safe for their whole life because there wasn't something known about them at, what, the, you know, 13-week amnio that you could have told that would tell you, okay, well, that baby is unsafe, this baby is safe, no child is safe, right?
Or if you're coming to the workplace, you better keep your baby out of the way and have
yes.
a plan to do that.
Yes.
By the way, that plan costs you 90% of your salary.
Yes.
It's totally insane.
It is. And it just starts with the idea that all of these connections to other people are optional, right? And because they're optional, if you opt in, that's a problem you are making, not a problem that I have to respond to.
As if society and the common good doesn't need women to have children,
yes.
for
well,
crying out loud.
And also as though your boss was not himself a child, right?
Yeah, totally.
For my day job, I work on family policy, and a lot of the times when I'm talking about, well, you know, you could have a baby bonus, a benefit to children, people are like, well, is it fair to take away from people who are childless to give people who are children? I'm like, everyone is children.
Yeah.
Childless people are also children when they're born. Like, when you think about how do we make the world friendly to children, you're not picking and choosing winners and losers. There's no adult who was not a child. It's the most universal benefit you can imagine.
How does this translate in practical ways to the workplace? You know, and there's a lot of women who, I hate this about how the world has changed. I would love it that if it were optional that a woman says, I want to work, versus today where so many women who work don't even want to and feel like they have to, if they'd rather be home full time. But knowing that so many even, you know, again, it should always be optional, but knowing that some of them feel forced there, and then they find themselves in a place where they feel like they're failing at everything.
Yes. Well, I think what's interesting is that when you look at even survey data, the plurality of women with young kids hope for part-time work, right?
Yeah,
a lot of people
yeah.
think both, I love being a mom, I do want to support my family financially, but I like having some adult things I do too, right?
Getting my head out of the diapers for
right.
a couple hours.
Whether,
just kind
whether
of makes me a better mom for some people.
Yeah,
right?
Whether that's a volunteer thing in your community yeah. where you're kind of holding up part of your school yeah. your kids go to, or whether it's paid work. Most women want something they're doing alongside being mothers, and that's the historical pattern, right? Like
yeah.
stay-at-home moms historically were staying at home on a farm doing work alongside their whole family. The question is, what kind of work accommodates the needs of children? You know, I think one thing that's actually a little positive in the wake of COVID, and the question is how to capitalize on this, you know, little bit of light amid that darkness, is there's more flexible hours now available, more telework, more hybrid work. I myself go into work 2 days a week, and the other 3 days I work from home, and I have a little bit of flexibility about my hours that lets people say, okay, you know, my family are not this extra secondary thing that has to get squeezed in around the margins of my work. I can do something that's valuable for someone else and have room for my family if we have a bit of a dialogue about how can these two things fit together. There are some kinds of work where you need someone on the clock every moment of the day, like a hospital, or even then you're working in shifts, right? But there's no sense of, we can just close the hospital down so everyone
right,
can rest.
Right.
But most kinds of work, I'm a policy wonk. I don't need to be on 24-hour call for anyone. I'm just not that important. The work I do isn't time-bound in that way. So finding more ways for people to have room for a yes to their family and space out work, share work, flex work so that you can give a strong yes to your family and the medium yes that this kind of work requires.
Radical flexibility would be something that comes to mind, right?
Yes.
If someone's dependent on you, you need to be available for their interruptions.
Yes.
How does that not ruin productivity? What's your response to that?
Well, you know, I think you've got to be a little realistic about how much work many people are getting done in a
yeah.
day, right? Like, so the question is a little bit, you know, in a normal job, it depends what kind of work you do. Again, some jobs are full steam all the time. You really can't be distracted taking on those jobs. But for a lot of jobs, you know, people are answering personal email, doing a different thing.
Oh,
like,
totally.
Does it matter if I'm putting in laundry while I'm doing those things rather than, you know,
yeah.
reading Twitter? It
yeah.
doesn't, right? So if we can be a little realistic that your job is paying you for what you are producing more than just your total hours, then we can say, okay, well, how can I get done what needs to be done for this job in a pattern that works both for my boss and for my family?
Yeah. And that's easy for us to do. It's a small company. You want to be open to life. And people who come here who have small children find it's kind of a mm-hmm. dream scenario. You know, they can leave if they need to. They come back. I just care that you get the stuff done.
Yeah.
Stay in touch. And I don't care about the hours you're doing the things mm-hmm. in. Praise God. For large companies and big corporations, do you have any hope that some of these principles can actually be implemented?
I think it's actually easier for a lot of large companies okay. because there are more people to shift work among. I think it's hardest for a really small group where if someone goes out for 3 months, who's covering that? Like, where are you going to get a three-month temp, right? I think I've had to do that where I was trying to figure out, who's going to cover my maternity leave on a team of four people? No one else is at exactly my level. So what can we delegate? What are we genuinely going to say? Well, as the cost of having Leah as an employee, we're going to pause this project for 2 months and then pick it up when she comes back, right? But I think part of that is realism about the fact you employ human beings, not disposable widgets. So if you don't build a company that can accommodate human beings being human, not only do you not have room for young parents, which I think are the most obvious and the easiest to try and sneakily, illegally avoid employing, mm-hmm. right? But you just don't have room for someone who gets sick or is in a car accident. So you have to say, okay, does my company have enough slack that I can be realistic about the fact that people will get ill, will take bereavement leave, et cetera? Mm. I think that's what it means to be a humane employer and a steward of your employees, not an exploiter of them.
Mm. How do you think your book, like a lot of well thought out things, mm-hmm. it's going to make people angry on all sides?
Yes.
Right? So you're excited yes. about that. I love that about you.
I'm hoping to get invited to debates.
Good, so. Good. What do you predict? What's gonna upset the trad wife, right? And what's gonna upset people who are, you know, you have a feminist manifesto here mm-hmm. that it's, you know, it might seem benign to feminists, like, hey, she's on our team.
It's why it says feminist yeah. and manifesto, so people aren't, you know,
that's
willing
it.
To think like, oh, this is probably a very gentle and calm
book. Yeah, right?
Like, I'm like, this book is no, here to pick
get,
a fight.
They'll get partway yeah. in, and like the typical feminist is going to hate you partway in this book. Because
I hope she feels roused, right?
There but you not, go, roused better.
Not hating me, because part of what I'm trying to do is make these connections that don't feel natural to make across certain political mm. divides, but are real, right? Mm. So a lot
yeah,
of the pitch
the,
I'm making—
where do you see the problems coming from on each side?
Yeah, go. So a lot of the pitch I'm making to what you might think of as a traditional or mainstream feminist is like, look, like I agree with a lot of the story you're telling. We live in a world that's often inhospitable to women, that asks things of women that are not just, right? Asks women to make compromises that aren't fair, aren't in keeping with her dignity, asks her to pretend to be a man in ways that aren't doable and are not right, right? And there was a lot of pushback against even just Sheryl Sandberg's lean in where it's like, all right, well, women can succeed. You just have to learn to never apologize for things, interrupt people. And it's like, people were like—
Be the worst version of a man.
Right, right. And I think that's often the pitch, right? And that's why
like, I don't even want to be that jerk.
I'm careful about saying, you know, a world like shaped for men versus a world shaped for a certain image of men that isn't always mm-hmm, a great mm-hmm. fit for men, but it's a little less hard for them. Because many feminists don't like that. They say, well, what if— I want to apologize when I've done something wrong because that's how we live in a society. Like,
yeah.
So I'm like, you agree with me here, here, and here. I have news for you. There's one other part of being a woman that women are asked to make unjust compromises about, and it's abortion. And you know, part of my pitch there, and I try and be clear that there's a lot of the seeds for this even in mainstream feminism. It's just people aren't willing to let them blossom, right? So Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a strong advocate for abortion, like, always said that she didn't think the grounds for abortion were the grounds that Roe actually offered, privacy. She thought it was a very weird way of constructing mm-hmm. it. Why would privacy give you a right to abortion?
Right.
She thought it was about equal protection under the law, that women couldn't be equal to men unless they were, in a certain sense, interchangeable with men. Hmm. And if men are able to abandon a child easily, right? It's not easy as a matter of morals, but for a man to abandon a child, he just has to walk away and disappear.
Hmm.
But for a woman to abandon a child, she needs someone's help. She can't just walk away. The baby is too intimately connected to her. So the pitch, and it's really there in Ginsburg, the pitch for abortion is that women need access to whatever it takes, poison, scalpels, et cetera, so that they can be like a man and being as free to walk away from someone wow. who depends on them. And I think when you frame it that way, people can both recognize the logic that this is a equality that depends on interchangeability, and interchangeability that can't truly be achieved, that they reject in other cases, and that this is not just a thing I oppose purely for the sake of the baby, though I do. Mm. I oppose it for the sake of the woman. That's an unjust thing to tell a woman, that her equality with men is premised on being able to equal them in vice.
Wow. Wow.
And I think for a number of women, even though they're not going to read the book, I don't think, I hope, right? Yeah. But like, you go like, I've immediately changed my mind on abortion, right?
Yeah.
I want them to say like, you know what? Like, that does bother me. In every other case you've brought up, I don't want to give up my pro-choice views, but why doesn't it bother me for abortion?
Yeah.
Why would this be just to ask of a woman here when in every other case where a woman is punished for not being a man, I say that's wrong?
Mm. And not only that, but the way we set society up to be for a woman to succeed is mm-hmm. to then come into a man's structure mm-hmm. and thrive as someone dominating.
Mm-hmm.
It feels to many women like that necessitates abortion.
Yes.
Because the child will then come in the way. Mm-hmm. Well, because dependence comes in the mm-hmm. way. Human interconnectedness comes in the way. And if we get rid of that, we'll have a happier world. We're
yes.
all just automaton. Well, we're all robots, totally disconnected from each other. I love that you read The World Outside Your Head, by the way.
Yes,
what
so good.
What a phenomenal book that
yes.
is. We just celebrate this radical disconnect. It's horrible. Okay, so that's going to be the debate you'd find mm-hmm. yourself with on from the left. The far right within the church, which is very real and growing.
Yes,
it's strange that like I never thought that I would be labeled liberal to some people. It's like what just happened?
I mean, some of the ways I irritate those people are very obvious. I'm a mouthy woman who wears pants, right? Like that's
and
true.
And you dare to even talk about having a job?
Yeah.
Anyway,
that's true
even,
before
I don't
the
even
book, right?
Like
yeah,
that.
I work, I have kids, I have pants, right? But no, I think the thing that's harder for folks is conceding the real good that's part of mainstream feminism, that you're so eager to build up walls against its excesses, you ignore the real injustices that people are responding to. That, you know, it's a real mixed history across, you know, the range of feminists, but there are so many ways that women were not valued as women. And that because mainstream feminism focuses on blotting out one form of what makes a woman, her fertility, that we ignore the ways that, you know, women's ability to care for their family were ignored, women's real attachment to their children ignored when they just wouldn't get custody in divorce cases by default because they also couldn't work, right? And I think it's a real mistake to look at the sweep of genuine good done by American and British feminists in this tradition and say, you know, because of this one poisonous fruit, I want to reject the whole thing, rather than how have these people been earnestly and in good faith seeking the good for a long time, and where have they gone wrong, and how can I connect to the deeper good they were seeking to talk to them? But I think if you look at the life of Abby Johnson, who worked for Planned Parenthood and then changed her mind on abortion, she went to work for Planned Parenthood because she cared for women. You feel this sense of a baby makes a woman vulnerable. I want to take care of the woman. That's a good instinct. Right. The question is, what truly serves her? And you can't get people walking out of abortion clinics without connecting to the fact that they, in most cases, entered them, including as employees, because they wanted to serve people who were vulnerable. Yeah. You've got to then start by expanding their sense of who the vulnerable person is.
I think if we have a contemplative life and we're walking through life with Jesus, we're not going to live reactionary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's where a lot of people within Catholic circles go wrong in giving zero credence to the things that have come about because of feminism. I mean, just Google the woman trying to run the first Boston Marathon, and mm-hmm. you can see this isn't ancient history.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's men ripping at her shirt, screaming at her because she wants to run and jog.
Yes.
So you literally mainstream. That was okay for them to scream at her face for running?
You can also see in America particularly, and I love Daniel Williams's Defenders of the Unborn, a history of the pro-life movement before
yeah.
Roe. You see this kind of coming apart from people who should be natural allies. You know, that the pro-life movement and the progressive movement in America sat alongside each other much more naturally.
Mm-hmm.
Because the same people who are concerned about temperance, right, are concerned about virtue, are concerned about protection of the vulnerable, mm-hmm. are also concerned about abortion. They look at all the different ways that our world takes someone vulnerable, treats them like trash, and even constructs a system of profit around making them vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get the same people who were smashing up saloons saying that, of course, like, abortion is a moral horror and a crime. But you see those come apart in the U.S. so that, you know, these different questions about virtue and the vulnerable look like they belong to different sides, and they don't.
Mm. Speaking of the vulnerable, there's two groups that you know, your book is directly talking about women mm-hmm. and making the world a better fit for women
mm-hmm.
in every space. But I think it makes the world a better fit for everybody in every space.
Yes.
And one of those groups that would benefit if the world actually was more open to dependence is people who have special needs, people who suffer from disabilities. You bring up a beautiful example of 4,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
unearthed a grave of a man from Vietnam. Tell us about that. And really, the measure of a society and how advanced it is how well it cares for the most vulnerable. And we are failing by every measure because of this strange, again, take the worst of masculine yes. ideals. Total independence. So therefore, dependence is less than. So anyway, go ahead.
So this is something where the archaeologists, you know, uncover a burial site, and what they see is an adult who had, you know, profound skeletal deformations, who couldn't necessarily feed or care for themselves, and who grew to adulthood. And what does that tell them as archaeologists about the society? It meant that someone was willing to carry this person, willing to feed them. And this was a subsistence society, right? So it's not as though it's today where we have so much wealth and so much excess that we have the freedom to succor someone without it costing us something. It was harder for them than it was for us. And here's someone who grew to adulthood in a state of profound debility because they were loved and they were valued. And you think about what is the trace we're leaving, and you look at somewhere, you know, like a number of European countries, well, you know, how many, if you went through the graveyards, how many skeletons would you find of adults with Down syndrome? Very few, right? The archaeological record we're leaving is of one where, as we've grown wealthier and wealthier and better at identifying people who have profound needs, we're killing them. You know, we're killing them early and then killing them late again. When you look at Canada, Europe, the expansion of euthanasia, where, you know, then you will see people who live to a point with debility. But when you look now through our paper records, right, through our written record, that we decided that the fact that someone was vulnerable made them a licit target for violence at both the beginning of life in the womb and at the end of life through euthanasia. And I think what's really startling and horrible is that when you look at, for example, in Oregon and Washington, you know, there's data on why did people seek euthanasia, the do surveys for people seeking medical aid and dying. And it's not pain that people cite as the primary reason. It's the fear that they will burden their families. So why did I write this book? Why make the case for dependence? It's because it's part of our life. And if we can't think of it as part of our life and part of what connects us to each other, then we will think that the fact that we need other people means we shouldn't be alive. The fact that people might love us and take care of us, care for our bodily functions, change our diapers, like, would not be something that they undertake as an act of love, just as our parents did for us. It would be in some ways unpersoning ourselves to need that and unjust to them to ask it, and it'd be better to be dead. And more people are making that choice. So, you know, I think it's such a strong contrast from when we're not looking at ourselves, when we look through the historical record, when we find people who were cared for in their debility, we admire that civilization. But would we admire ourselves if we viewed ourselves from that same remove?
No, we don't. And in between dependence, when people are born in the end, if there's an illness, if there's anything wrong, you're safely removed from everybody's sight. And you're in a hospital somewhere. And one of the refreshing things, you go to a mission in Haiti or poorer countries, you see it. The death is in your face, need is in your face. But people are generally happier and more connected, and they feel necessary.
And one of the things I do suggest, and, you know, in the run-up to the book, I actually even ran a bingo challenge of just ask things of other people, right? Of, you know, ask someone to bring you food when you're sick instead of DoorDashing when you're too sick to cook for yourself. Because part of what you're doing in those small moments, I think there's that temptation of, well, I'm really sick, I feel terrible, you know, but I have money and someone will do this for me as a stranger, and I'll have compensated them because I'll have paid them. Well, what are you teaching yourself and your friend in that moment? You have the option to go elsewhere. But if you choose to ask your friend and say, I'm really sick, would you bring me something? Then you're telling your friend, I don't think you'll hate me for needing something. And I'm also asking you just to do it for me. I'm not saying, I promise the next time you're sick, I will bring you something, so don't worry, we'll be even, right? Like, if you just ask openly, what I find is, first of all, that you are hopefully a little bit reassured that you are lovable, even when you can't do anything for someone else and when you can't pay someone to take care of you as a way of canceling out that you can't do anything for them. And what I find is, if you make small asks of your friends, they feel freer to make big asks of you.
Yeah. And they feel dignified. They feel like there's a purpose.
Yes.
You know, referring to Haiti again, the suicide rate's near zero. Everyone feels necessary. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
What? Gosh, this is maybe too big a question, but I probably can't throw any question at you that's too big.
Let's try.
But why do you think we've gone this way? When you describe that ancient society and you describe right now, I mean, this path so obviously makes people feel miserable in our isolation. Why the heck did we start valuing this radical separation from one another, independence at the cost of everything else?
I point to two causes, not exhaustive, but one, you know, less and less we believe that we're dignified in ourselves because God loves us, right? Yeah. And so if that's the case, and you see this actually in some of the early arguments about abortion in America, where after World War II, there was some discussion of like, well, people derive their value from being loved by each other, right? But if no one loves you, do you have value? Now, for Christians, there's always that bedrock, you know, truth that God has loved you into existence. You can be the most spurned and despised person in the world. You can even deserve being spurned and despised because you've committed some great crime. But none of that will alter God's love for you. He's conserving you in being moment to moment. He's already answered the question of, do I want this person to exist? Yes, right? But without that bedrock, then the claim to existence gets weaker, right? If no one wants this person to exist, well then, what then? And then I think the second thing is just, we are more prosperous. We have more and more of our lives in moments of seeming independence. Mm. You know, we're healthier than ever. That's a good thing. I don't want to in any way say, I wish everyone were sicker, poorer, because then we'd remember we need each other. Mm. But I think it really creates the obligation when we are richer, more prosperous, healthier, how do we actively connect to each other's need when it's not as obvious and when we spend more of our lives being able to pretend that we don't and won't need anyone.
Mm. The other big group that's going to benefit is men.
Yes. Right,
and thank you for giving a whole chapter to us.
Whole chapter.
I felt so seen by chapter 8, right? Men are suffering from some horrible ideas about what masculinity should be about. You know, I mean, there's what God made and it's beautiful. And then there's social constructs. And then we have camps of people who are far on each side that say it's all social construct or it's all directly from the hand of God. And no, there's a mix here, right? And a healthy society builds on what God has given in a healthy way. Like, just like you lay out doing with dependence. Mm-hmm. Like, this isn't something to be ashamed of. Physically, we're dependent, we're porous in a way that men aren't. And let's structure around that and celebrate it. But men, there's the beauty of we are hardwired to act upon, right? To hunt, to gather, to defend. And those are awesome things. Mm-hmm. To sacrifice our bodies for the good of another, to serve in a heroic ways. I think that's from the Lord, right?
Yeah.
Not to say that takes away from what women are called to do. Mm-hmm. There's
they complement each other.
Yeah, right. It all fits. I mean, women, gosh, I could go on forever about the beauty of what he's inherently ingrained in femininity. The social construct that we've put on top of that that's crushing is that, therefore, to say I'm in need of anything is unmanly.
Yes.
And undignified and weak.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is why you look at the stats of men and suicide.
Yes.
And it's so high because they literally haven't been taught how to say, hey, I'm not okay. Can somebody help me out? Which should be a part of regular life for us, right? So what you're pushing for will a society that takes those feminine attributes and says let's mainstream those too, and not think those are less than, is going to help
me.
So,
I think part of the way you know to get into this idea of is that part of what makes you vulnerable is just taking on something larger than you can do yourself. Right. One of the stories I talk about in the book is a man you know who's a veteran who's quite old whose wife is in an assisted living center. And he gets snowed in by a big snowstorm, and he visits her every day. So he's trying to dig out as he can get the car down the road to the plowed street and go visit her one more time. He visits every day, doesn't want to miss one. But he's old, so he's shoveling. It's a huge snowstorm. He can't shovel out by himself. And he posted to his local Facebook group and said, I'm so ashamed to ask this, but I can't shovel out. Like, can someone help me? Dozens of neighbors turned up, right? But he waited till his hands were bleeding before he asked for help. And he felt ashamed when he did. And I think part of the challenge is seeing that if you live a big life, an expansive life, of course you will hit things you can't do by yourself, right? Sometimes that need will come to you just in yourself, that you're sick, that you're older, that something is hard for just you personally. But part of what I want men to know is, you know, that sign that you need help from other people is part of what happens when you do big things, right? Hmm. He had this huge love for his wife. If he didn't have her, if he was alone, it wouldn't matter if he was shoveled out, right?
Mm.
He needed other people because his love was so enormous. And that's not a bad thing.
Amen.
And then when it comes to that kind of complementary idea between men and women, you know, I've got a picture of a mom and a baby on the cover, right? I talk a lot about pregnancy in the book, which obviously is not a male experience. And I think there can almost be a tendency sometimes where people are like, well, you know, women can do something so beautiful, can carry a child, and men can help. It's very beautiful, right? Like,
they can shovel the driveway while she carries the baby.
And I think importantly that undersells men, right?
Like, yeah.
I think there are two ways that men and women distinctively image what it means to be host to something greater than yourself, something you can't author. And for women, it's pregnancy, and not every woman will have a baby, but every woman is the kind of person, the kind of being who can do that. Mm. And for men, it's priesthood, that only men can confect the Eucharist.
That's
and
cool.
Even though a smaller percentage of men will do that, then women will have children. Each sex is distinctively made for this.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the question for men who aren't priests is, how does my life reflect the gift that I'm the kind of being that can do this, like, in my life, even when I don't confect the sacrament?
Mm.
And then I am going to go back to pregnancy here, but because I think it shows a good example of what men and women do together, right? So when I'm in labor with our children, that is something, to some extent, only I can do. Mm. But it's also something I can't not do. And I found this very reassuring. And I see this as a really strong image of how men and women respond to need in general, that they can differ in the particulars. I found it reassuring that you can't stop being in labor. Because I was like, what if I'm not up to this? I'm like, luckily, that's irrelevant. It's like a roller coaster. Even if you're like, this is too much for me, you can't get off the roller coaster till it stops. I'm like, well, that's a great source of peace for me.
Yeah.
All I have to do is exist, like, and hopefully I'm contributing. But I can't mess this up by opting out because there's no opt-out available. That's very reassuring. For my husband, there is an opt-out, right?
Yeah.
He can be physically overwhelmed by labor. He could run out. You know, for my first daughter, you know, we had an emergency C-section, and the hospital's kind of attentive to where they put the stools because sometimes the husbands stand up to see the baby and then they drop because they faint, right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the time, not all of the time, men and women's response to need follows these two main patterns, that women often are exposed to other people's need in a way that's less chosen, where withdrawing our love is less of a possibility, including physically, right? I can't, while pregnant, I can't just go, take less calcium. I need that calcium for my bones. Like, doesn't matter, the baby's gonna take it, right? But men often are extending their strength over someone in a way that they are actively opting into and could choose not to do it. So it takes that active running towards need. Mm. You know, and for each our labors, it did feel like a partnership, right? Because there were parts only I can do, but because I'm so focused on having the baby, only my husband can run interference with the doctors. Like, only he can take care of me in a very particular way that goes beyond what the nurses can do, knows what I need before I ask it, is the one who has the presence of mind to be verbally praying at a moment where I'm just giving myself entirely to this physical process. So I always say, like, well, when we had the baby, and then sometimes we're like, oh, come on, like, you had the baby. Like, don't minimize her. I'm like, we had the, like, we made the baby. I was there when we did that, right? Like, but then we had the baby. Our strengths came together to make this hard thing possible for me.
Mm.
And I think what's so hard for men and makes it hard again to share their own need is men have excess strength, right? They're taller on average, bigger on average, less ill on average. Mm. What is that strength for if not to extend over others in protection?
That's awesome. I love, too, how you brought it to a very practical, that, like in the workspace, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not treat the guy's fatherhood like it's an unnecessary thing or an add-on. If we're going to have a world that's more porous and interdependent, then a guy shouldn't have to say, I am so sorry my kid called and needs something.
Mm-hmm.
No, I have a kid. I'm not sorry.
Yeah.
And my kid needs something.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be back in 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? That's totally okay.
I'm good at being a dad, right?
Yeah.
Like,
Go, Dad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything else burning on your heart about this book or this message you want to share?
I really hope this is a book that can kind of be a way for folks who are Catholic who are watching this to have conversations with friends who aren't, including across that abortion division. And one of the reasons I hope that is, first of all, I think you'll see a lot of places where people care about the vulnerable and the dependent in some domains and have trouble extending it and need a friend to kind of talk through that disjunct. And this will give you some of those avenues for conversation. I think every one of your friends needs to be reassured, even more than your Christian friends, that they're lovable when they can't do things for other people. Mm. And talking to them about that explicitly is a real gift. And I think more and more, what I say when I talk to people about this, including when I talk to folks who are young, who are strong right now, is that there's going to be a time in your life when someone you love, your parents, an aunt or uncle, is old and is ill and is looking at you to understand whether their life is worth living. Mm. And, you know, it's not just about whether you can give them a good answer in the moment. It's about whether your life to date has been you two reassuring each other that need is natural and that asking for something doesn't make you despicable, mm. doesn't make you unhuman, doesn't endanger the good life of the healthy person who's caring for you. And it's very hard to catch up all those months and years of anti-catechesis in a single conversation at the end of life. You've got to be preaching it your whole life. And it starts by you asking for help now so that someone understands that you don't think asking for help unpersons you.
Mm. Amen. A truly Christian society is founded on this idea that God finds each person worth dying for.
Yes.
I think on one level we reject that because it's in some ways easier to act upon the world than to just say, okay, I'm going to receive love. That's a hard thing.
And if we don't believe that other people will love us when we need things from them, how on earth can we know God, who we cannot recompense and who does love us?
Yeah, you're pushing for it. I mean, really, a society that's founded on profoundly Christian ideas. That society that all of a sudden Europe goes from having coliseums to having lots of hospitals and lots of places that care for the poor and lots of, you know, places that are handing out food and what just happened?
Yeah, it's from the very beginnings of the church that one of the scandalous things about Christians was that they don't expose their children, right? That when you have an excess child or disabled child, they don't put them out to die. And it was notable to the Romans and odd. I think Christians have a responsibility to be just as odd now to call people to love of the weak.
Man, I got chills thinking about that. Because it's amazing. We take it as a given that, well, of course you wouldn't put your kid out in the cold. That is not a given.
No.
There's so many things.
And people are still doing it. They're just doing it veiled by the womb.
That's right. Yeah, we do it in a very sterilized environment,
yes.
And we call it something else.
Mm-hmm.
But wow, man, there's so much people take for granted. We're still enjoying the fruits of Christianity and forgetting the tree.
Yes.
This comes from a worldview that says God loves you. I mean, really, that's the basis of the whole thing. Wow. So thanks for doing this. This is not just pushing for a world that's more open to who women are in all different settings, but who humans are.
Yes.
Because I'll tell you, man, if anybody's tired of living under the ideals that come from the worst caricature of what a man is, it's men. We're done, man. We're just toast. We're done. Nobody's happy in this. Nobody's happy with this much crazy independence. It's not real. So thanks for pushing for a more human world. You're awesome. Get the book. Share it. God bless you guys. I love you. Thanks for being part of building a more human world with us. We'll see you next time.